and welcome to Stark Talk here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Edie Stark, and my guest is an artist and illustrator with a life story as colourful as her art. She's worked as a journalist, waitress, labourer, cleaner, circus ringmaster, music manager, professional gambler's undercover assistant, burlesque producer, and donned a pink wig to be Auntie Joan, more of which later. In 2016, she was shortlisted for the World Illustration Awards. Her book, Paper Cut This Book, shows the techniques and includes the templates and paper for this beautiful craft. She invites you to gather the tools of paper cutting, an A3 cutting mat, a pack of 20 number 11 scalpel blades, one number 3 scalpel, double-sided sticky foam spacers, a roll of masking tape and needle nose pliers. Once you've got the tools, then the fun begins.
Yeah, and then prepare to meditate, Edie. That's how it's done.
Boo Patterson, paper cutting is a slow art, but your book, on the other hand, is a runaway success. Rights have been sold in America, Australia and China. Colouring in has been amazingly successful. So is this really, is this another form of meditative art therapy?
I like to think so. I mean, I feel when I'm doing anything creative that you get into a flow state where you don't notice time passing, and that essentially is meditative. I'd had a lot of friends and fans writing to me saying, I love what you do, but I've no idea how to do it. Are there books? And there weren't.
When did your interest in paper cutting begin?
I remember making my first 3D work out of printer paper when I was about 3 or 4. I was watching You and Me with my mum. I remember it very clearly. I covered it in glitter and I really enjoyed making it. And I still have lots of my papery things from childhood. I made a frog that jumps if you pull a string, and I always made pop-ups and things. So I've always used paper as a medium while also dabbling in other mediums. I draw and do stained glass and things as well.
You won the Ducks Prize for Art at Harris Academy, but you didn't go to art school.
I didn't go to art school. My upbringing was, let's be euphemistic, chaotic. And so I felt that I really had to get out and be on my own. I mean, I had to be independent from quite a young age. And being at university or art college was just going to mean more time stuck in that kind of chaotic environment. My next best subject was English. So I thought, well, I'll go and be a journalist then. And so immediately went into waitressing and basically blagged my way into journalism, because in those days you didn't have to go to university. I just phoned up the Scotsman and said, you know, I want a shift.
So when was this?
92, or I was about 21, and I'd worked as a waitress. I'd moved to Edinburgh, living hand to mouth, and I just had to have a gin and phone up newspapers, because I, you know, it's scary. I had no idea how to do it. I did have one friend who was in the NUJ, and he kind of gave me a brief guide to subbing in the pub, none of which I remembered because we were in the pub. But actually, after 25 years subbing, I realised that learning it in the pub was probably the best place to do it.
You're saying that your childhood was chaotic. Why was it chaotic?
People involved are still alive, so I don't want to be disrespectful to them. But what I will say is that my dad, who is dead, was a very, I used to call him the terrifying Victorian. And he's 6'2", fireman, very angry all the time, just like really repressed Calvinist, although atheist Calvinist. And, you know, I just remember my whole childhood really just walking on eggshells waiting for him to explode. And you never knew when he would explode. To this day, I cannot stand sudden loud noises because it's my dad suddenly screaming at me for something. It was usually something you'd not done, or he was just angry about in general. And so I think I get my sense of injustice from that experience, and that I might be why my work is so politically driven, because I can't bear injustice.
By the time you were 21, you had moved house 8 times, mm-hmm. and you went to 7 different schools. Mm-hmm. That must have been very disorientating.
Yes, I remember reading a book by Oliver James about, you know, the dynamics of family and everything, and he said that the only children who can possibly survive mentally from constantly moving are extroverts. And it just so happens I am. So thank God that I was, because actually, you know, now I have friends with children, I can completely see how you would want to give them a completely stable background, and you'd want everything to be normal all the time, and you'd want no surprises, really, because they need boundaries and they need a sense that everything stays the same. And I definitely didn't have that. But if I'm trying to be positive, it forced me to make friends. It forced me to be unafraid of new things and new experiences. And in a way, I relish it now. As an adult, I like going to new places because I think I'm going to get new friends forever. You know, I love having friends all over the world.
And you do.
And I do. So there are positives from it, but it's very discombobulating to be a gypsy. And I think once it's kind of set down in your schema of your mind as a child, you don't really lose it. So whether you like it or not, you're a gypsy forever. And I definitely still am.
Well, you live between Scotland and New York. Mm-hmm. That must be pricey for a start.
Well, it's, if you live in New York properly and you're not being a tourist, then it's not really. It's not as expensive as Sydney.
It's where you've also lived.
Where, well, on tour there for 3 months at a time. New York is hard because it forces you to raise your game and it makes you fight to be there. And if you're there, everybody else accepts that you've won your game to be there. And there's a lovely kind of camaraderie, not just with artists, but, you know, the guy on the street, that if you're living in New York, you know, we've all got something in common because it's so hard to exist there.
Your first job, as you said, was as a journalist when mm-hmm. you weren't waitressing, that is.
Yeah.
You did the motoring column, amongst other things.
I did. I did a classic car column for The Sun for a bit. And I used to be mad about classic cars, but I don't have any now. I sold my last one at the end of last year to pay for a trip across America. But I wouldn't say no to an Austin Healey 3000 if such a gift were to present itself.
You also like vintage clothes.
I do. And I've always liked them. My mum wears vintage clothes and always had them. So, I mean, the coat I'm wearing today is from 1880. And this dress is from the 1970s. You know, my favourite TV programme at the moment is Repair Shop on BBC Two because it's about beautiful things being fixed. Mm-hmm. And when I'm not doing art, I'm fixing old stuff.
You worked for all of the main broadsheets and the tabloids.
Yeah.
So you obviously learned well when you're in the pub. But you did have a traumatic time, didn't you?
When I started in 92, there were some women on features. That's really a daytime gig, features, and sub-editing is a nighttime game. I was usually the only female sub in a newsroom full of men. You know, I like men, I get on with them, I'm a good laugh, and I'm a hard worker, but I was horrendously sexually harassed and sexually assaulted and bullied from the very beginning to the very end. And with all the Weinstein stuff, I have found myself screaming at the TV going, it's not just films. And I did.
Why didn't you go to your editor?
I did. And I was like, he sexually assaulted me in front of all the staff. Yeah, I mean, he's just having a laugh.
What do you mean by sexual assault? Or groping?
Groping. Painfully.
But you see, you sound like you're somebody who can look after yourself. Why were you in the position of being bullied?
Isn't that funny? I am confident in certain areas of my life. I hate confrontation because of my terrifying dad. And so I will go massively out of my way to avoid it. I complained all the time. I said to one HR woman, you know, this guy has been bullying me for a year. And she said, are you a bit of a sensitive wee flower? There's no point in fighting. You can't fight City Hall. I've grown to realise. All you can do is leave City Hall.
And did you leave?
And I did leave. And I remember, well, I developed a heart condition. And I remember the doctor I went to see said, I don't care how much they're paying you, it's not worth a heart condition at 36.
When you were still working in newspapers, you became a music manager mm-hmm. for the jazz singer Sophie Bancroft. Mm-hmm. You also started the Acme Workers Club with DJ Lenny Love. Mm-hmm. That got you loads of publicity at the time. What was your unique selling point?
Well, we were sick of clubs where it was so expensive to get in, and then you were buying drinks for £4.50 each. And you couldn't hear each other talk, and you couldn't have a laugh with your friends. So we decided to do an anti-club. You could get mince and tatties for £2. You could get a pint for £1. And we would raffle a frozen chicken at the end of the night. So people would come straight from work on a Friday and change into their glad rags in the toilets and then sit at these long trestle tables playing board games. And then we'd have kind of cabaret on and magicians, and lots of whom have gone on to become incredibly famous.
And you were Auntie Joan in a pink wig.
Well, I had to do that because I was working at the Sun at the time. And I wasn't sure, actually, what the contractual obligation was. So I just thought, best just not to tell them. They'll never know. And actually, yeah, I was in the record. I was had like a page lead in the record in this pink wig. And nobody noticed. Yeah, we wanted to kind of combine working class shtick with extreme glamour. So I would be in ball gowns and the pink wig, and we'd be serving mince and tatties. It was a kind of, you know, it was all about the irony. But it was a good laugh. It's just made no money for us. That's the problem with all good ideas.
Yeah, you've not been very good at making money.
No, they lead directly to poverty. Good ideas.
You went on to co-produce a large-scale burlesque show.
Mm-hmm. Burlescapades.
Did your employers know about that?
No.
And tell me what your pseudonym was.
I was Miss Boo Boo Bear, B-A-R-E. It was my way of trying to escape this awful job. You know, it's not the job that's awful, it was the atmosphere that was awful.
Did you ever perform burlesque?
No, I have no interest in that whatsoever.
So no feather boas then in the vintage wardrobe?
No. I've got a feather cape, but that's from the circus. It's more, I admire those who do it because I found there's two types of burlesquers. Those who are in it for the theatrical element, and those who are trying to find some kind of catharsis for their trauma in life. And usually in burlesque, the difference between burlesque and stripping is that there should be a narrative. The whole point of burlesque was that it was political lampooning in the theatre.
Just looks like dancing to me.
Well, there is that kind of beautiful feather fan dancing. You know, it's a kind of feast for the eyes. But really, burlesque should be about some kind of political lampooning, and there's lots of that about. So I admire those who do it, but I've just no interest in getting my kit off.
You're listening to Stark Talk on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Edie Stark, and my guest is artist and illustrator Boo Patterson. You were working in Edinburgh, and then you went off to Ibiza.
I went to Ibiza 17 years running. It's got that atmosphere that I love about New York, which is acceptance of everybody, and a creativity about the whole island, and they're very welcoming. So I immediately felt at home. I worked as a PR just for a year, and then I thought, I've never done that whole university thing where people got to have a skive. And then me being me, I went over and I did kind of lie around for about 2 weeks, and then I thought I better earn some cash. So I ended up working for this very, very posh villa company cleaning rich people's toilets.
The CV gets even more interesting, Boo, because you worked as a labourer in a large private garden when you came back to Edinburgh, and then as a putter-honour at the bookies. Explain.
Right, well, the last burlesque event that we had at the Assembly Rooms was supposed to be the huge moneymaker, and Lehman Brothers went down. Nobody bought any tickets despite blanket coverage in the press. Every single penny I had was wiped out. All my PR clients cancelled overnight. The burlesque club died on its arse, and I was penniless. And, you know, all the banks had been laid off, so you couldn't pick up temp work. There was no bar jobs. Literally, there was no work. And my friend, who's a sports reporter, said, I don't know if you're interested in this, but it might be a way out, is that I went to school with a guy who's a professional gambler, and he has a few putter-honours all over Britain putting on bets for him because he is barred from betting shops because he wins so much. Basically, the gambler puts thousands of pounds in your account, and you then take that money to bet on his horses in bookmakers in Edinburgh.
Did they not start to recognise you?
Well, of course. Like, so, but you have to have a backstory. So the way it works is you get the deposit. I would strap the money to my legs because, you know, there's a whole thing about the poodle runners getting mugged. Obviously, you draw a lot of attention to yourself if you're placing thousands of pounds of cash a day. And I was the only woman I ever saw gambling.
And an immediately recognisable woman. You're, what, 5'10", blonde, very beautiful, striking.
I must say the camouflage was difficult. So I wore kind of just combat trousers and a fleece. And the cashiers initially were very suspicious, obviously. And they were really kind of arms folded looking at me. And I said, so, oh yeah, I'm putting this on for my granddad because he's like, you know, he's had a stroke and that. And he doesn't get out much now. Gran's died and he had his leg cut off. So like he can't get to the bookies. So he texts me his bets and then I put them on for him. All that was actually true. You know, my granddad did have a stroke and he did lose his leg to gangrene, but he died in 1986, so I couldn't take bets off him no matter how big the buttons on his phone were. So the more I became friends with the cashiers, which I did in the end, I actually got one of them, their son's work experience at the Evening Times. And so I became friends with them. I was seeing them, you know, 34 times a day.
34 times a day?
I would place at least 34 bets a day. Between two different betting shops.
Was it stressful?
Incredibly. I would be in a cafe between two bookmakers with loads of betting slips from both shops, thousands of pounds in my legs. So I would get a text from my gambler saying, you know, Style Council, 3-1 Fakenham or something. And I would run as fast as I could to the betting shop to put the bet on.
And nobody said, here's Faye Dunaway walking into the shop again.
No. my God. Thank you. No. They never said that.
How long did you last?
Nearly a year. It was horrendous. The cafe I was in grew very suspicious. And they were saying, oh, you know, why'd you keep leaving? Why'd you keep, you know, because I was running out of the place 34 times in 4 hours. And you have to leave all your stuff behind. You have to leave your keys, for, you know, everything you have to leave in the cafe. And I would have this awful recurring dream that I would be running and I would trip on the, there's a black rose made out of pebbles in Rose Street. And I would trip on the black rose and I would smash my teeth into the concrete and I would just be sitting there with this drool and blood and tooth dribbling down my front. And people would be going, you've got to get an ambulance. You know, I would be going, I'm going to get to the cafe. Because all my stuff, my whole life was in there, you know, and they didn't know what I was doing and I had all this money on me for somebody else.
Was it illegal?
No, it's not illegal to place bets for somebody else, but it's, you know, they don't like you.
Winning.
So there was
Did you ever think about putting your own money on it?
Lots of people have asked me this. I didn't have any of my own money. It went directly to the mortgage. I didn't even have really, well, I didn't have enough to eat. The idea of like me suddenly having thousands of pounds where I could copy my gambler's bets was absurd. I did one day put on a bet. I was looking up at the screens and there was a horse coming up in the next race called Boo. And I said to the cashier, my favourite cashier, oh, there's a horse called Boo. He went, yeah, I saw that. You should put a bet on. And I said, oh, no, I can't afford it. And he went, oh, just put a little one on then. So I write out my slip. I put my £2 on top of my betting slip and I slide it over the counter to the guy. And at the same time, he puts two house brick sized wads of cash and slides them back towards me and says, there's your winnings. And I said, well, like I say, I'm not a gambler like my granddad. And he went, that's OK, Boo. I hope you win. When I went outside, I phoned my gambler and I said, I put a bet on that horse called Boo. And he said, how do you feel? And I went, like, I finally know what it's like to be alive. You know, it's like being in love. You had this enormous rush of just, oh my God, hope and freedom and, oh, everything's going to be different. And I finally got, like, why addiction works, like why gamblers sit and play the puggy, like, you know, like they're hypnotised, because it is the hope that you will be free from this ink-stained past of uselessness and despair. Everything's riding on this horse that's, you know.
Boo, did you win?
God, still running, mate. Of course. Of course I didn't win. That's not the moral of this story. Boo does not win.
Oh, Boo doesn't win, but also you never really seem to escape stress either.
No. That's maybe why I like paper cutting, because it offers me a relief from the stress. Yeah. I must say, I have had a tough paper round. I hope for the best and prepare for the worst.
You ran off with the circus. That was pretty extreme.
Well, again, that was done through my situation. It wasn't... I didn't go wake up one day and go, God, you know, I really must go and join a load of coke snorting carnies. Like, I must, I'm desperate for that life. I had been working for the famous Spiegel tent for a few years doing their PR. And I'm a muckeriner. So I, you know, anything they needed done, I would do it. I'd break the chairs up and I would, you know, rip tickets and, you know, whatever needed doing. You just, it's a bit like, I kind of grew up partly on a farm and it's a bit like farming. You've got your own work, but you also work collectively. And I enjoy that. I like being around people and I like helping out folk. So I fitted in. I had a different jazz singer at this point.
Who you were managing?
Who was managing. And during the gambling, I had said to her in my office, which was the cafe in between the two betting shops, I think we should go to New York because that's where jazz is, you know. She was like, well, we don't have any money. And I went, well, we'll just have to get money. I took out, I don't know what she did, but I took out 20 grand on credit cards. I did have a spare bed that looked like George Best's bed covered in money, but none of it was mine. and winning betting slips, none of it was useful to me. It might as well have been rubles that was on my bed. Anyway, I took out £20,000 on credit cards and went with my jazz singer to New York to try and break her there. I ended up naturally lucky boo with mice running across my bed at night. We're living in utter squalor in the Lower East Side, but living these nights of pure hedonistic joy of $15 cocktails and the best jazz musicians in the world and just, you know, amazing, amazing. But it was a tale of two halves. You know, I was living off one pizza slice a day so I could just get into a club, and it's a two drink minimum, so you need to spend $30 plus tips. Luckily, those two drinks get you drunk. That's the one good thing about New York measures. So let me just say, the New York thing failed, but I don't regret it for a second. I came back and, you know, a week or so later, my dad died. And that was, you know, because he was such a difficult man, it was, you know, it was conflicted and it was kind of weird. There was kind of no closure because I hadn't seen him for years and all. It was a very odd time. And then I ended up doing a PR job that was really awful as well, very stressful. So I texted the owner of the circus and said, can I come back? Like, I just I can't cope living in this sort of very straight environment of PR.
What was your job at the circus?
Then I was their publicist. But you did kind of do everything. You did, you know.
I thought you were the ringmaster.
Well, I did do that later. Because you do everything. You can't possibly work at a circus and do one job because it's collective.
You'd have liked the top hat as well, I would imagine.
I bought that myself. So I do love hats. There's no, I'm not gonna lie about that. I do love hats. So he said, yes, absolutely, come back. A few months later, I was at the front of the Spiegel tent in George Street, dressed in like 1950s ball gown with a white top hat at that point. And David said, you look like you should be painted into the facade, because they have this beautiful facade with all the freaks on it. And I was like, I would love to be painted into the facade. Can you make that happen? And he went, do you want to run away with the circus? And I went, God, yes. Like, who's going to say no to that? You never.
Me?
Well, yeah, the thing is, that's true. Nobody runs away from anything unless they're escaping a difficult situation. You don't run away with the circus because it's a hoot. You go because you're lost. And, you know, my friend in New York always says that people who feel lost in life feel at home in New York because everyone's lost there. And I think that's why it feels so much like home. It's the only place I've ever been that it does feel like home to me. You can't work for the famous unless you're a vintage person. So I had all the gear.
Oh, this is the famous Spiegel tent you're talking about.
Yeah.
And what was the circus called?
La Clique. Anyway, I ended up, one of the things I had was a black tailcoat from my friend who's a QC from the 1900s. And I already had a top hat and I put that on and had black velvet hot pants. And And I was like, oh, this is good because it's warm. Like, you're finally warm on the door, which is freezing at night. And I was going, oh, this is kind of ringmastery. You know, it's like, you know, it looks quite good. So anyway, I went into one of my vintage shops and they happened to have a red hunting pink tailcoat. So I got it, I put it all together and I was like, oh my God, it's a ringmaster. Members of the audience were just like constantly I would get 200 photos taken before they even went into the venue. So the ringmaster thing just went bonkers.
Moving swiftly forward here, because I've got to do that with you because we're running out of time. Oh. You set up BooYorkCity.com, which is an online arts and culture magazine. And then you started to make art again. And in 2016, you created Papercut This Book, which was published by Pavilion. So that was a cause for celebration at long last.
Yes, and also coincided with me getting into the Royal Scottish Academy, which was huge, just validation that I've probably been looking for my whole life.
Life has been very eventful and varied for you. Now that your book is on the shelves and it's selling well, do you feel more settled? Do you feel that, that luck might just have turned for Boo?
No, I don't feel that, Edie. I have suffered from depression since I was a teenager, you know, sometimes quite severely. And I certainly am not free of that. People always think I'm very resilient because I sort of bounce back all the time. But I don't feel resilient at all. I feel weak. I don't know what settled is. I've never experienced it. I don't know if I'd recognise it if it punched me in the face.
Well, do you want it?
I don't know what it is, so I don't know if I want it. I constantly feel like I have to keep moving. I constantly feel like I have to be producing. I never really feel relaxed. Maybe I'm just not that kind of person. Maybe there are people who, for whom it is impossible to have that kind of life. You know, is being settled an ambition? I think maybe being settled is, the word is kind of akin to settling. And I don't think I'll ever be settling for anything. Like, I will always be questing forward for the next thing.
Well, I know that you have got some secret next things.
I do up your sleeve. I'm not saying that, you know, good things don't happen to me. They do. There's definitely an unlucky streak that means when bad things happen, they happen very badly.
I feel as if I ought to be telling you to break a leg at this point.
Which is one thing I've not done yet.
Boo Patterson, all the very best.
Thank you.
With your next adventures. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And you can listen to that programme again by logging on to bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland. Stark Talk is a Stark production for BBC Radio Scotland. On digital radio,
92 to 95 FM,
and 810 medium wave,
BBC Radio Scotland.